Good evening. Welcome. Thank you all for coming to Pueblo Divine Science Center. How many people are here for the first time, never been here before? Great. Lock the doors. That's right. Again, thank you so much for joining us for what promises to be a very special evening. Every now and again, we get somebody that speaks truth in a way that is unique. And there is only one truth in the end, and it's all the same truth. But every now and again, somebody has the capacity to stand up and speak that truth in a way that really gets your attention. Maybe it's from a different angle. Maybe it's the first time you've heard it where you need to be. That's what I believe we have to look forward to this evening. It's a church, so let's start with prayer. So each of us, in our own way, just go within. And let's take a moment to be grateful. For each one of us knows the truth. There is only one truth. There is only one divine source of all. And each and every one of us is connected to each other and to that divine source. In fact, each and every one of us is made in the very image and likeness of the power of love itself. And what we know to be the truth is that we can never be separate. We can be individuals, we can be different, but separation is just not something that is any kind of truth whatsoever. For we remain eternally connected in this bond of divine love in eternity as the brothers and sisters, the family of the divine love that made us, created us. So for this moment, just leave all your cares and worries and concerns, anything in the past, the busyness of the day, leave that aside. For that is the past, and the unborn future that is not yet here, it's not yet a part of our experience, so just let that be. And let us all, in this state of gratitude, also be present, be fully present. For each and every one of us is here, I believe, by divine appointment. Each one of us is here to be open and receptive to receiving information, life-changing, life-affirming information. I believe that to be the truth. I am grateful for it. And we just let it all be what it is. And so it is. Amen. Our guest speaker this evening, by any measure, is a remarkable woman. She's an activist, public commentator, scholar. I'm going to brag on her just a little bit. She's currently the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Colorado Springs. She's professor of women's and ethics studies at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She's got a bachelor's in English from Clark Atlanta University, a master's degree in American literature, a PhD in American studies, both of those from Purdue University. So this is just somebody who I guarantee you never wants to write a paper again as long as she lives. She's an author and an important voice in the community. So would you please give a warm welcome to Reverend Dr. Stephanie Rose Spalding.
Good evening. How are we? Awesome. I want to start by first saying thank you to Reverend Sean for opening up the invitation and allowing us to be here in all of the Divine Science congregation, community, fellowship, all of the words. And I also want to thank dear friend Carolyn Cathy, who is just wonderful in terms of connecting people. I guess that's why she's a great realtor. She sees people's needs and is able to help them navigate through that. So thank you. And thank you all for being here on tonight, because it's obviously a gorgeous day and gorgeous evening outside, and you could be somewhere doing anything other than this, but you have chosen to come and have a conversation around moral beauty, living a social justice practice. Many people are not trying to have this conversation right here, right now, in these times. But I am grateful that you are. because these are the kinds of conversations that will move us closer in relationship, that will take us further in our journey, and help us to live out a vision that we have in our spirit as well as in our communities. I didn't necessarily come to this work easily. I won't spend too much time telling you the backstory, but I can say the divine is always present and orchestrating our lives. I honestly thought that I would be Claire Huxtable by this time. That was not the path for me. And it's okay, especially if we yield to those things that are happening around us and we are able to hear the spirit. I came into academic work and academic life because there was a professor at Clark Atlanta University who saw something that I did not and asked me to envision life differently. If you know me, then you know I talked back for a really long time and resisted for a really long time. But when I finally yielded, it opened up to this space and to this place of doing this work of moral beauty and a living social justice practice. From the time that I was a young girl on the south side of Chicago, I grew up in community that was deeply rooted in spirit and in faith. And so for me, not just only reciting, but having to sit with and meditate on Micah 6:8, what does the Lord require of thee? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. That for me, even as a young child, has become a mantra for life, for any and everything, whether that is in a classroom, in community, or in congregation. What does the Lord require of me? And to pursue this question of justice and walking in the space of humility with who I understand or what I understand to be the creator of all, that is how I move forward in this world. And I understand it doesn't mean that everybody agrees, but for me, it is a place of grounding. It is a place of centering. And so on this evening, as we have this conversation, I really am not on Facebook. I am looking at my notes on my phone. But as we have this conversation, wanting to ask the question, what is the concept of moral beauty? And how do we envision and enact it as such? So, as a professor and a pastor, I get to do multiple things, and you all have an assignment right now. Just in groups of two or three, ask yourselves when you hear this phrase, moral beauty, what comes to mind? What does it mean? This is not rhetorical. I will give you 2 minutes to share. So, welcome back. What comes to mind immediately for you as we hear the phrase moral beauty? Not all at one time. We can sing together. Yes. Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you.
So when I think about the simplicity of her saying that my behavior could show up and be not very Catholic. Mm.
I will tell you this. I don't always have an answer, but I have good questions. So as we go through this conversation, and it will be a conversation, I want you to think about for yourselves and for the life that you live, what moral beauty may be. Justice is a word that many of us hear, use, and pursue quite frequently. We think of it as something so simple and easy to define. When I was a young girl, for me, the idea of justice was if someone treated me unfairly, whether that was on the playground or in the classroom, I would go to the next responsible person, hopefully an adult, not always, but the next responsible person and say, A, B, and C happened to me. How do we rectify it? Yes? Does that seem like justice for us all? But I learned very quickly as I grew older that sometimes justice is complicated. Sometimes it doesn't always live on the lines that are black and white. I remember at one point in my life, I can just say this, I was probably a really persnickety, I would say persnickety kid, you know, because that sounds better than the definition, right? And some things came easier to me than they did my brothers, so to speak. Where everyone else was truly athletic and gifted in hand-eye coordination, me not so much. So I was not the best athlete, but I promise you, if there were a sport called speed reading and competitions to win awards, that's my jam right there. And I, again, in my younger days, as a, you know, persnickety, smart-aleck kid, I like people to know that. That's not always moral beauty, right? Like, don't get ugly about it. And so where academics came easier to me did not always come as easy for my brother, who was definitely more athletic. Didn't mean he was not academic, but one thing we know in terms of education, children deserve, I believe, personally, collectively, individual learning plans. Because if we attempt to educate all children the same way, we will end up with expectations of forcing fish to fly. They cannot do that, right? But, so we got to this place, and this was before we really evolved in terms of the kinds of conversations around education and education and curriculum. My brother was a year older than me, but academically, I could perform better than him. And it came down to his senior year in high school, and he had to put together a portfolio. And my mother came to me and she was like, do that for him. And I was like, what? It came down to whether or not he would graduate if he had his portfolio together or not. And my mom woke me up in the middle of the night and was like, type that up, get it together, get your brother's stuff done, because he's gonna graduate. You can only imagine my response to that. And my dad used to pop me in the lips a lot of times, saying those two things under your nose would get you in trouble. But but the sense of justice for me was like, how unrighteous and unjust is that? Particularly, you are a public school teacher, and that is called plagiarism. At least that's what my teacher said. Thankfully, you all didn't have a black mother from the west side of Chicago. Needless to say, my brother did graduate, but in my young mind, I did not understand at all how that could be just and right. We have these ideas about justice being right and wrong, black, white, simple, you do this thing and these are the consequences or results. But as we think about moral beauty and social justice, I ask you to consider, if this 17, 18-year-old black male did not graduate high school, what would it mean for his mother? What would it mean for his life? And yes, there was a system in place that articulated this was the way that graduation is conferred in this system, but my mother was having none of it because my brother would not become a statistic because the assignments and the curriculum did not necessarily consider who he was as an individual. 16-year-olds don't necessarily have all of that context floating around in their minds when things are happening and presented in front of them. But it's not just 16-year-olds. It's many of us who don't always consider what are the systems in place that, yes, even though there may be a law or rule or precedent, but does it mean it is right and righteous for everyone to participate? And so I'm reminded of this Langston Hughes poem that says, "Justice is a blind goddess, is a thing to which we black are wise. Her bandage hides two festering sores that once perhaps were eyes." Again, I reiterate what my mother understood about justice in that moment was that my brother at 17 would not become a statistic. And later, not only did he earn a high school diploma and a bachelor's degree, he earned a master's degree and is the dean of the high school from which he graduated from. And so what does justice really look like when we have had systems that privilege and oppress particular groups of people and have not considered how and why and the ways in which we engage those systems and how they might hinder the lives and the purpose for others? We do talk about a legal system in which there are consequences and for everyone's actions, but those actions don't always seem fair, equal, or equitable. Just recently, I was in a conversation where Angela Blackwell, the founder of Policy Inc., was speaking in Denver. And she recalled, or she asked all of us to do the research and recall, if we are talking about a structure of policing in the United States, for the vast majority of us, and I know that sometimes these conversations are not always the most comfortable, but for the vast majority of us, we say there is a set of rules, there are a set of laws, and this is the consequence for what should happen if you violate those rules and violate those laws. Does it always happen in that manner? But not only does it always happen in that manner, if we are not calling into question even the origins of policing in our country, we can never get to this place of justice. How many of us know how policing began in the South? 2, 3. Policing as an institution or organization began in the South as a way to capture runaway slaves. And I have a problem with the phrase itself of runaway slaves, right? Because if you're looking for liberation, you're nobody's slave. So if policing itself is rooted in the capturing of bodies couched by race, class and citizen status, we are going to have conflict year after year, generation after generation, because the fruit of the tree cannot be different from what the roots are embedded in. If we think about policing in the Northeast, whether that's New York, Philadelphia, how did policing begin in the Northeast? Anybody? As a response to immigrant labor forces and practices. Hence the term paddy wagon, where it literally meant to round up Irish workers that resisted the labor forces around them. In the Southwest, y'all getting the hang of this? Policing, what do you think? As a way for settlers to maintain or to articulate their property rights as Sooners or frontiersmen versus those who were occupying space. This is the root of policing in our country. And so if we're asking the question, why are we having these kinds of conflicts today? We have to go back to the roots. And as Langston Hughes says, yes, at one point we might have had eyes, but right now these festering sores are sitting with us. So when I think about social justice, when I think about the laws and the way in which, again, whether it is through spirit, because I can guarantee you that Bible is a book of laws, rules, regulations. And so, such is the Quran and Torah and others. When I think about what is at the root, how then do we live out what is just? So again, justice cannot simply be in exacting the practice of the law, because we have learned too many times in our lives in this country that the law is often flawed. And so when the law itself is flawed, then we have the duty and the responsibility to challenge and change the law. So just some of the things that are going on in our lives right now, if we think about what's happening in our country, in our communities, right here in Pueblo, we have issues of wage gap, health disparity, wealth disparity, decreases in life expectancy. There are some parts of our community here in Pueblo where we know that environmental racism is real, that some people get better water than others. Others get better wages, housing practices. It's happening here locally, and it's also happening nationally. These are just some of the things that are going on in our country, in our society right now. In the U.S., women who work full-time earn about 80 cents for every dollar that white women earn. And I say this in a broader context, because we know when we disaggregate for African-American women, it's 60%, 60 cents on the dollar. Hispanic women, 55 cents on the dollar. And then we ask ourselves, why is poverty perpetual? African American men, 75 cents to every dollar, and Hispanic men, 66 cents to every dollar. We haven't even begun to look at indigenous communities. According to the National Committee on Pay Equity, a female college graduate will lose $1.2 million over the course of her working life as a result of gender gap. I am 20 years out of undergrad and still paying student loans. I'm a tenured professor. And I can guarantee some will say, well, you went into a soft science, and if you had have done economics or engineering, then you'd be making more. Is that how we want to measure justice? For women ages 15 to 24 working full-time and year-round, the wage gap is $4,373 per year. And by the time women reach the age of 45 to 64, they earn $15,000 plus less than men per year. At every educational level, women and people of color seeking employment are more likely to be unemployed than white men. Is because they don't have the skill set? Institutions like Harvard have done research study after research study that demonstrates sometimes just a simple name on a resume will cause a person not to get an interview. They can have the exact same, they literally have done like exact same resume, sent it in to a hiring, an HR professional, and same degree level, experience, everything is the same. But if the name sounds ethnic, that is the person who will not get a call back, will not get an interview at upwards to 80% of the time. So now they are actually, even at the University of Colorado, asking us not to have names or gender identifiers on applications, to simply have numbers, because of implicit bias and how it is impacting even employment opportunities. According to a 2011 report from the Higher Education Research Institute, first-generation students were less likely to complete their college degree in 6 years than their peers whose parents had at least some college experience. So imagine many of your young people here in Pueblo going to school for the first time, even it taking 6 years. I just told you that I'm still living with student loan debt. And I finished my bachelor's degree in 4 years, did do a master's in 2, and 5 years for a PhD. But even in 4 years, the amount of debt that was racked up from student loans. So tack on another 2 years for first generation students, and this is a cross race. And we ask and we encourage and we say that higher education is the pathway to success. I'm not going to read all of these, skipping forward. 27% of self-identified Native Americans live in poverty. 27%. Native women are 3.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted in their life than any other racial group in our country. And we already know that the average woman on a college campus, 1 out of 3 is likely to be sexually assaulted or raped. Nearly 1 out of 3 LGBT students skipped school in the past month because they were simply too afraid to attend. So we don't even have students finishing school because they're scared out of their minds to be present. Just right up the highway, we have the highest youth suicide rate, the second highest youth suicide rate in the country, the highest in the state. What are we robbing ourselves of by not allowing people to be safe, to be who they are? Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender teens are twice as likely to consider suicide because of the way they are treated, 3 times as likely to create a suicide plan, and 4 times as likely to make a concerted suicide attempt. Recently, I have been called into question by a number of people in different places, but particularly from communities of faith, because last year I made a decision to be the Grand Marshal of the Gay Pride Parade in El Paso County in Colorado Springs. And I had people asking me later, a year later, they didn't come to my face because, you know. Right. But later coming to me and saying, well, did you do this for so-and-so, this person who was in a position of power, who was bankrolling your life at the time? And you can imagine, like, use your imagination for what that means. And I looked, and these are people who are leading congregations. And I had to look them in the eye and say, it's not simply that El Paso County has the second highest rate of youth suicide. They particularly come from one school district, which happens to be District 20, which happens to be one of the most populous faith-based communities in El Paso County. If I did it for anybody, I did it for them. Because when I think about what it means to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God, regardless of what it may or may not say in sacred text, there is no child on anybody's planet that can be saved who is dead, who does not want to live. So that is what justice looks like for me, is to take the heat from communities of faith and say, I love you and you are welcome here. Towards a living social justice practice. We've been in this conversation of diversity and inclusion for about 40 years now, maybe starting in the late 70s, the early 80s. Everybody was like, diversity, we got to do diversity work, right? This is after affirmative action, and we can talk about that later. By definition, what do you believe diversity means? It's not rhetorical. What does diversity mean for you? Crosses all borders, all lines. Anybody else?
The opposite of
homogenous. Cornucopia of all types. Anybody else? Yes. All of creation, yes. How do we know in our communities, in our spaces, that diversity is happening? What are our measurements for that? Yes. When you have African American and Chinese American grandchildren. Diversity in most people, whether it's corporate, communal practice, is about quantifying difference. Being able to look and see and say that this is, we can number, it's like, okay, if there are 20 of us and the population said, so we can count difference and see it, feel it, touch it. What about inclusion? What does that mean for you? It's to provide the space and to bring people to the table, right? So for some people, they say diversity is inviting folks to the dance. Inclusion is making sure everybody's on the floor moving, right? I'm gonna let Carolyn lead that. Inclusion provides this space to make sure that people are participatory and have space to be who they are. I used to use a metaphor for diversity and as it relates to my family, I like to eat. And as soon as we leave here, Allison is going to make me go get tacos. And my family likes to eat. And so having holidays or participating in family gatherings is fantastic for us. But we got vegans and vegetarian, and my dad is just straight up like carnivore. He probably eat your leg if necessary. So we got all of these different needs, and diversity for me means inviting and making sure everybody is at the party, right? Everybody is at the barbecue, even if they're not eating barbecue. Everybody is there. Inclusion means that now I got to cook macaroni and cheese with cheese, and then macaroni and cheese with that other stuff that really ain't cheese. But that's what vegans eat, because that's what my sister is, and she wants some macaroni and cheese. And I'm like, we got to call it something. Those are noodles and soybean. But inclusion means that we will have like real macaroni and cheese. Then we will have what she wants that looks like macaroni and cheese. And then we got to have some ribs, because my dad doesn't think that it's a barbecue without ribs, you know. And he will talk about it for 2 weeks. Like, y'all going to have some ribs? Like, who's going to? That's inclusion, making sure everybody has something to so that they can participate. Imagine having a meal that you can't even eat. But what then is social justice? Any ideas? Well, I'm glad you asked. We ask ourselves on a surface level, who is in the room? These are the questions that lead us to thinking about diversity. And even though we might be thinking about diversity, it doesn't mean we are always doing social justice. So again, assignment for everybody, just really quickly, take a minute and talk to each other. If random strangers walking down the street with no idea, I do want you to ask yourself these two questions. How do you describe yourself? And how might those who don't know you describe you? And when I mean don't know you, I literally mean if the police were asking who was out there, how would they describe you? So just take a moment and share with each other how you describe yourself versus how people who don't know you describe you. Welcome back. Welcome back. As you were talking with your partner, did you notice that were there differences in the way you describe yourself versus people who don't know you? What are some of those differences? Yes. Absolutely. And it's not just for you, it's for all of us. That when we think of ourselves, we think about our character and our attributes, our aspirations, what's inner within us, and the things that we want people to know about us. But when we first are meeting people, we immediately go to what? To the external, to the social categories, to the things that may not have as significant meaning for who we understand ourselves to be. Again, studies have determined what is the very first thing that people identify about another person that they don't know from 100 yards away. So 100 yards is like a full football field, right? Am I right? Yeah. I told you I'm not good at sports. That's a whole football field away. What do you think is first that people notice? I'm sorry? Race. It's number one. 50 yards. What's next? Gender. And then 25 feet. Nope. Nope. I'm sorry? In what sense? Class status. We are trying to assess, is this someone who is beneath me, a peer, not someone that will looks rough house or what have you? Top three things that are on our minds for strangers in our midst. Think about that as we, and in my understanding, even here at this congregation, when we're asking the questions about, well, how do we get so-and-so and so-and-so to come and worship with us, to commune with us? The first thing that most of us are doing is scanning the room. Is it anybody that looks like me? And how will I be impacted? Because very few of us enjoy being tokens. And so even, or, and sometimes they're not other people that look like me. But what I have learned as a professor of women's and ethnic studies at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs is, even if I have pictures of people on the wall that look like my students, if I have rainbows or images and books about Stonewall, people feel safer. If my email address includes my pronouns, then it signals to some students we can at least have a conversation, even if I don't see myself in you. What does our marketing material look like? What are the books that we have around? How do we create, even if we don't first have the individuals here in our space? How can we think about diversifying even our own spaces? Who is in a room and who is not? That's one of the first steps. And yes, that's a part of diversity, but that is one of the first steps, asking ourselves consistently, who is in the room and who is not? It is not that our differences create inequity. It is the way that we value them. This is a commercial, ironically, for Android technology that I don't use. But get from this video? Playing all the keys. On both sides, he's playing all the keys, right? But what is strange? I'm sorry? The sound changes when what happens? So what's the difference in both pianos? There, that it's not melodic or even enjoyable to listen to a piano that has all the same notes. It is the diversity of the keys that makes music, that creates melody. The thing, the language that we articulate as universal relies on diversity. We don't all have to be the same. In fact, if we were, it would probably drive us mad. So first accepting that for ourselves, that there is beauty in difference, it's actually what enriches us. That's what we hear. That's what we are like. I could sit in a 2-hour Prince concert because we know the variety of the notes and the experience that is going to take place is actually what is enjoyable. And so as we think about that, and we think about ourselves being in spaces where we are different, it's not the difference that drives us to these places of inequity. It is how we disregard or do not value those differences. We all can talk about a time, and it's not about race or class or gender, but we all can talk about a time where we felt excluded. But when people recognize that you had something to offer and it didn't have to be exactly like what somebody else had, that's when we could stick out our chest and relax and be ourselves in that place. So again, coming back to these systems to embrace those differences is the practice of inclusion. To allow people to shine in the fullness of themselves is the practice of inclusion. And so we have learned for most of us, okay, we want to go forward. This conversation right now, everybody's talking about equality versus equity, right? Have you all seen this cartoon before? So equality is what? Giving everybody the same thing. And sometimes we are so stuck on, I need to give everybody the same thing so we can achieve equality. That is not justice. That is BS. When we think about the systems in our lives, in our communities, justice is not simply giving everybody the same thing. In my younger days, I could probably lift my leg high enough, but if I walked in, I can't do it right now. Not as flexible as I used to. But if I walked in this room and pulled out from my trunk a pair of 7.5 stilettos for everybody in this room, what could you do with those 7.5 stilettos, Reverend Sean?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. Can't, maybe sell them on eBay, right? But the vast majority of us in this room cannot walk in a pair of 7.5, 3-inch stilettos. Most of us don't want to walk in those. You can't do anything with those. But that's what equality looks like, right? I came in and I treated everybody the same. Carolyn was no different than Allison, and here we are. I did a good thing by treating everybody the same. But did you do the just thing? Equity means what from this image? Giving people what they need in order for them to manifest in the space to call forth their purpose. Some people in here are going to need New Balance diabetic gym shoes. Others are going to need one shoe because we have a prosthetic leg. Others are going to need a wheelchair. Giving people what they need in order for them to move forward and to fulfill their beingness. That is what equity looks like. But it's not always just, even in that place. What do you think justice looks like? Just looking at this image, what's the next step that has to happen? Why is there even a fence to begin with? This is what our world looks like today, particularly in the United States. There's a reality where some people got all the doggone boxes in the world. Others have no box and they're in a ditch. And we're like, how come you can't pull yourself up from your bootstraps? What? Like, I have been pulling myself up, but we've been living in this ditch. You can't even tell that I've been climbing. That's another Langston Hughes poem. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. And then we move to this place where, okay, well, I'll just treat everybody the same and we'll be good. No. Did you remember I was in a ditch when we first started this? And I'm like 5 feet and the fence is 8. And so we're like, okay, well, we're going to help you at least see over the fence. But the work of social justice is to question, why are there barriers and fences to begin with? This system that separates and creates a space where some can see and participate in the experience and others can't, that's part of the problem. That's what's driving us into these places where community against community, because we haven't questioned the system itself. Again, going back to the example of policing, if policing is rooted in stealing other people's bodily autonomy, we will never have good policing practices. Maybe we don't even need policing. Maybe we need to think about restorative justice as our model for healing communities, because policing hasn't necessarily worked in the way that it has been rooted and grounded in this country. What are other ways to pursue and to rectify harm when harm has been done? Just because it looks like that today doesn't mean it has to look like that tomorrow and forevermore. It wasn't always this way. This is the movement that I am living for, that I am encouraging. How can we think about the system differently? And so when I am making macaroni and cheese, slow cooking ribs, making whatever is soybean and noodles, to call my family into a social justice practice is to ask the question, why are we in a position that we can have an abundance of food, so much so that tomorrow you won't even want to eat it? Why are we in a place and a position that we can whine about having cheesecake in December with strawberries on it in Chicago when it's nobody's doggone strawberry field? Like, for real, strawberries do not grow in Chicago in December, or maybe like ever. But where is this food coming from, and whose lives does it impact? And who is not able to have these kinds of celebrations? What is the heart and the root of this celebration in and of itself? Those are the social justice questions. You can tell I'm not the favorite at the holiday gathering. They're like, just cook, please. But that, for me, those are the things. Because we are in a global crisis, and our food source is a main reason why we're in the environmental climate crisis that we're in. Bananas don't grow in North America, not in the abundance that we like to eat them, and year round. So what is the global cultural economic impact of making sure we got bananas in our smoothies. This is the work of social justice. So as we leave today, what is required of us? How do we do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with the divine? Thank you.
Well, I don't know about you, but each one of us here has gotten a takeaway, maybe more than one. For me, it's ribs. I'm the white guy, so, you know. But seriously, there is on the wall behind me a remarkable, remarkable statement from Scripture. And those of you who are regular comers here know that this is not just something we put up there because it's neat. It's an important part of what we believe. So I began today by saying that you're all here by divine appointment. There's a reason for every single one of you who's here to be here, to have heard what you have heard tonight. So I don't know what your takeaway is going to be. I don't know what your next actions are going to be. I know that as a community here, we're going to be having inclusion and diversity classes and whatnot. This was just the first step to open that door. Because if we don't do this, nothing will follow. Nothing will happen. We will just keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And that is what? That's insanity. So I would just ask for you to be with the information that you've heard this evening. It may push buttons. Hopefully it pushes buttons. And it may cause you to think, have things wonder. And it's a very, very good chance that the most profound takeaway that you've heard this evening, you're not even aware of yet. So just be with it. Hold it lightly. Let it be a part of your life. And remember that if you don't change your thinking, nobody else will change their thinking. Nothing will change. How we all do that as individuals and then how we all do that collectively, that's the question. So again, I want to thank so much our fabulous guests for being here. Hope you'll come back and see us some more. And thank you all. So let's have a prayer as we exit. So I began with what I know to be the truth, and I believe I will finish with the same thing. Because the truth is, we are each and every one of us not the same, but we are not separate from each other. Separation can only be created in our imagination and then brought forth into our experience. We do it, all of us. But it is not the truth. The truth is that every one of us is linked as one. Oneness is the only truth. The Creator did not make us to be separate from each other or from itself. This is our truth. This is what we know to be the very nature of reality itself. We take this with us in our hearts, where it already resides. Pay attention to it, live with it, and we are so grateful to know it. We just let that knowing turn into a way of being, carry on in our lives as though the truth is the truth, and it is our truth and who we are, and we are grateful. And so it is. Amen.